Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Global Village Radio Show with your host, Dr. Douglas James Cottrell, and co-hosts Doug Bentley and Linda DiLembo. Tonight, the mystery of the Shroud of Turin, the ancient cloth embedded with the photographic image of a man believed to be that of Jesus the Christ. We'll delve into the many scientific tests and ongoing investigations of this ancient relic. We'll be taking your phone calls to ask questions about tonight's topic at area code 718-766-4421. Now, here's our Global Village host, Dr. Douglas James Cottrell.
Welcome and hello, my friends, to the Global Village Radio Show being broadcast worldwide on the Internet. To all our friends out there across the globe and to the faraway countries that listen into the show, welcome, welcome. I know you'll be listening to the show in your time zone, in the archives of the show. Welcome. This is our Easter show. It's Good Friday, and boy, have we got a show for you. We bring you the captivating discussions on spirituality, mysteries, human consciousness, and much more from around the world. I'm your host, and I'm thrilled to have you join us tonight and embark on another journey of discovery and understanding. As a lifelong learner and explorer of the world's wonders, I've had the privilege of traveling to numerous countries, immersing myself in diverse cultures, and connecting with fascinating individuals from all walks of life. Through these experiences, I've developed a deep passion for sharing the stories and knowledge I've gathered with listeners just like you, right here on the Global Village. Each week, we are going to explore new topics and spark controversy and curiosity. We're going to have debate and reflection. But together, we delve into the depths of history, the intricacies of language, nuances of culture, the profound spiritual influences, the limits of human consciousness, the noetic sciences, and much, much more. Our goal is to create a space where we can learn from each other, challenge our assumptions and broaden our horizons. I want to thank you for being part of our Global Village Radio community, and your presence and participation make our show what it is, vibrant, engaging, and thought-provoking forum. Ideas and perspectives from around the world are welcome here. Let's embark on this journey together and see where our curiosity takes us. Tonight, we will be delving into the captivating enigma that has intrigued scholars and enthusiasts for centuries. Around the world, I'm just going to have a little technical issue here. Around the world, has been embarked upon by scholars, and it's always a mystery. The Shroud of Turin, believed by many to be the burial cloth of Jesus the Christ, the Shroud, has been the subject of intense debate and analysis for centuries. The mysterious relic continues to spark conversations around the globe as people from all walks of life, like you and me, seek answers to the questions it arises. Tonight, we will be joined by our special co-host, Linda DiLembo, who will be sharing her insights on this perplexing artifact. Linda will share with us her latest determinations and what she has found out about the historical and spiritual context in which the Shroud emerged and the implications of its potential authenticity for both religious and secular communities. We're also going to open the phone lines so you can participate, my friends. Our listeners can join the conversation and share your thoughts on the Shroud of Turin. Are you a believer, a skeptic, or somewhere in between? We want to hear from you. Call in to make a comment or to ask our special guest and co-host a question on the Shroud. The number is called 718, to call in 718-766-4421. So sit back, grab a cup of coffee, and seek your favorite spot. Be comfortable and join us as we unravel the mysteries of the Shroud of Turin tonight on this episode of the Global Village Radio Show. Also tonight, before we delve into tonight's topic, I'd like to introduce my esteemed co-host, Doug Bentley, who will be joining us throughout the show to provide some enlightening content to the evolution of the name that carries great significance to the history of the Shroud of Turin. He is a retired educator and a minister with Many Mansions Spiritual Center, and he comes tonight with a special focus on tonight's topic to help develop the development of religious names and terminology. This is somewhat Doug specialty. Douglas has spent many years researching the intricacies and the impact of words and language, I should say, and impact on our understanding of religious figures and texts. Tonight, Douglas will share his expertise on the fascinating aspect of the Shroud's history, the transformation of the name Yeshua to the more widely recognized Jesus. I like that. Yeshua is the name I would prefer. As we explore the Shroud of Turin in understanding this linguistic journey, it gives us a valuable context of interpreting the relic and the historical figure it is associated with. Douglas will guide us with his insights through the cultural, historical, and linguistic factors that influence this name change. He's done a lot of research on it. He is the guy. And as you know, he has a special way with words, as he's demonstrated over the years. We're delighted to have Douglas back with us tonight. We're going to delve into this dynamic world of the Shroud of Turin right after this short message. We'll be right back.
Are you ready to experience life-changing wisdom, spiritual insights, and transformative knowledge? Come to the Next Hope Conference, May 26th through the 28th in Phoenix, Arizona. Powerful healing techniques and spiritual practices for personal growth. Interactive questions and answers with Douglas James Cottrell and other experts. Insights into global events and predictions through a spiritual lens. At Hope Conferences, we believe in the power of spiritual growth and transformation. Our mission is to bring together like-minded individuals and provide them with the tools and knowledge they need to unlock their full potential and answers to help you with future events. Join us in Phoenix, Arizona, May 26th through the 28th in Phoenix, Arizona. Go to hopeconferences.org. That's hopeconferences.org to register now.
You think about you and your family's health every minute, every day, not just when sick. We believe healthcare should bring results and rejuvenate the body. That's why Dr. Douglas James Cottrell compiled some of his best tips from his readings into a book, The Complete New Age Health Guide, Volume 1. From nutrition, anti-aging, and skincare to serious disorders and diseases like autism, PTSD, and cancer. Find out more at DouglasJamesCottrellStore.com or buy a copy. We understand people may have strong opinions that are different than our own. So join us and call in with questions and comments as we attempt to explore the unlimited human consciousness.
You're listening to the Global Village International Radio Show with your host, Dr. Douglas James Cottrell. Call in and ask a question about tonight's topic at area code 718-766-4421. That's 718-766-4421. Now, once again, here's Dr. Douglas James Cottrell.
And we're back. Good friend Doug Bentley will be making a special report a little bit later in the show. And we're going to go right now to Linda and say, welcome to the show, Linda. It's a pleasure to have you on tonight. And we have this exciting topic. It's Good Friday. Here it is, a perfect time to be talking about that mysterious object. It seems to polarize people. Is the Shroud of Turin really the burial cloth of Jesus the Christ? What do you know about it?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm not the be-all and end-all, but certainly I think we've all read and listened to different people speak on it and pondered the different things that have come up over the years. And I thought maybe what I would do is just kind of give you a rundown of when, you know, when this particular shroud came into everybody's attention. And it was back in the Middle Ages where this is where it's really well documented. And then when you go back beyond the Middle Ages, it's a little less documented, and that's where you have to depend on scientific information. But in the 1300s, it actually surfaced in, I'm going to say this right, I hope, Loret, France, and was put on display in 1355. It went on to Savoy, the Duke of Savoy in Geneva, and then also was placed in his chapel at, I'm going to say, Cambry, where the shroud was eventually, unfortunately, caught fire, and there were scorch marks on the shroud, as you know, and it was damaged. The Poor Clares there, the nuns, mended it, and the damage of the shroud, and was able to keep it intact. And that is actually very well documented all the way through there. And then in 1898, the first photographs were taken by Segunda Pia. They revealed a positive image, showing that the image itself was really a negative, like a photograph. And that's the part that is just so fascinating, to look at that. I mean, to stare at that image, you really, it takes your breath away. It went on. The shroud was hidden in a monastery during World War II. And then in 1973, scientists took samples to actually do some testing. And they came to the conclusion, at that time anyway, that the shroud was indeed of a scourged and crucified man and not the product of an artist. A lot of people had thought this was painted. It's very, very difficult in my mind as we get into the information on this that this could ever have been painted. In 1983, the ownership was given to the Vatican, and where it remains. And in 1988, there was an opportunity for carbon dating, and that's where it gets kind of a little bit iffy. Many people do not accept that carbon dating test, and it placed the origins between 1260 and 1390. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting at that point. Do you want me to continue, or would you like to make any comments?
No, I think we should address some interesting points you've made. I have seen close-up pictures of the Shroud of Turin. I was at a symposium in Oshawa put together by our friend at Coast to Coast and Strange Planets, Richard Serrett. He had some experts there. And they had a reproduction of the shroud in digital reproduction. And you're right. When you go up close and you look at that shroud, you know, the real thing must be mesmerizing, it must be some feeling, sensation, some sense of awe. I got some of that as I went up, and I'm looking at this face, looking back from a high-quality reproduction of the shroud. I can see the eyes. I can see where the thorns were stuck in the head from the crown of thorns, where the bloodstains were. You can see the hands where they were laying on the shroud, and you can see the bloodstains, not from the palms, but from the wrist. This is where Jesus was actually put on the cross, as it's been proven over time, that if you put a body up on a cross and you put nails through their palms, the nails just rip through their hands and they fall off the cross. But if you put it through their wrist, this is the place. And so there were the marks in this garment that was found a long, long, long time ago. I don't think anybody, Linda, debates the idea that this is certainly a man who was crucified. There's no, you know, second guessing that one. And there's just this amazing imprint that there's no smudge marks. This is what fascinated me. There's no smudge marks on this thing. This is like a photograph. And that we'll talk a little bit about that later, I guess. But how did that happen? Well, again, we'll talk about that in a moment. So when you stand there and you look at it and you see such detail and you see these things that were not known at the time that this was discovered, only later talking about the nailing of the hands versus nailing of the wrist and through the ankles, wasn't through the feet, it was through the oh my God, the big tendon, the Achilles tendon in the back of your leg. And no wonder it was so darn painful. He had to put, a man had to push himself up to support himself from suffocation on the cross. So you see all these things in a moment and you wonder, how can anybody say this is a fake? First of all, it is a person who was crucified. Second of all, the mystery of how the image was put on the shroud. And third of all, how it survived. And then what's in my mind, because Lynn, I'm a kind of a skeptical guy, carbon dating, you know, for all its hoopla, is pretty good, but it's not accurate. We're finding out now that, you know, they were out on the pyramids and carbon dating by 10,000 years. You know, there's artifacts around that have been redefined in the test, et cetera, et cetera. And then the motivation of the people doing the test is always in question. But the point being, if it isn't Jesus the Christ, which I'm not going to say it, I'm going to say it is a holy relic, and it has an amazing effect on people. But looking at that shroud, going back to that step where you mentioned it, how you see that shroud looking back at you, it's almost like Christ is looking back at you. And so going forward from that, what else do you know? I mean, the people who examine it, they take a little teeny tiny bit of cloth, right? How do they do that? They just take a little snippet of, how do they do that?
Well, they take fibers. I don't know exactly all of how they did that. Some of them, the test in 1988, I understand, they took it from the border, and that was the problem. That border was sewn in the Middle Ages, and that's the reason why it came back with a Middle Age date. There are other ways to and one of them, and I'm going to hope I pronounce this right, the Nillion test, which is another way to date it. It decays, has a decay rate, not, you know, similar to the carbon dating, maybe, I say maybe, actually more accurate. And there was a scientist named Dr. Rogers that demonstrated that this particular cloth had to be produced before the 300s, plus or minus 200 years. He was dating it around 50 AD. So that's pretty darn convincing too. There were other things that they did to try and to validate this particular cloth. And very interesting. It's really, in my mind, a miracle of light and spirit. And just the fact that there is an imprint on there, and it's not just two-dimensional, it's three-dimensional, which is where the spirit comes in, because it actually shows bones in the hands, etc.
That's right.
But
wow.
Yeah, it's very, very, very cool. Very, very cool indeed. But there are some other things. Would you like me to bring those up that were just so unique that as I was doing in my research on this, that you really can't deny that something else is going on here? There was another researcher, I think his name is Dr. Fry, and he was a pollen expert, and you may have heard about this. I'm sure a lot of us have, because I think it came out some time ago. But he actually did testing and was able to categorize pollen from all the different areas, and the most pollen that he found in that particular linen was indigenous to North Judea and Jerusalem. Which, guess what? That's where it should be from, right? And that is where this was kept for a good period of time and maybe exposed to air, et cetera. The second level was from Odessa, Turkey. Again, the next place that it was said to have been kept. And then Constantinople. And then finally southern France, which is where I began the timeline, if you will, of really well-documented of where this particular shroud was kept in France. So that is pretty, you know, I mean, if you've got a particular piece of pollen and it only grows in northern Judea or Israel, if it only grows in Israel, I mean, there's not much you can say about that. You cannot make that up. You cannot paint that in. So the cloth must have been exposed a very long time in that area.
You know, who would think to put pollen in a fake? You know, that doesn't, you know, it would be on a table. There would be some sort of artistic talents used. But who would think to put pollen in a linen? That didn't make sense. Wow.
No, it doesn't. And if you think about, and for me, I particularly like a saint called Saint Hildegard. She's from that, not a little bit earlier than the 1300s, but, you know, and they were interested in herbals and things like that, but they would have no idea of things of this nature. And even the most intelligent of them with the most access to information wouldn't be able to figure this one out. So it's just, it's undeniable. You can't argue with it, or at least I don't believe you can. So that's one point, and then there's a few other things about the shroud that, you know, when you look at the face, you were talking about the face, the eyes were really interesting to me in the sense that they were very flat-looking, and I had forgotten, you know, and of course I always think of A Christmas Carol, you know, with the coins on the person's, you know, eyes to keep their lids shut. Well, they had actually put coins on this particular man, and the man in the shroud had coins on them, and it was actually a Roman coin, and I'm trying to remember the name of it. I think it's a lepton, Roman lepton, and to keep his eyes closed. And they basically said that this particular coin was not one that anybody recognized. Well, in the future, after they mentioned that, there was a special minting, apparently, of a Roman lepton done by Pontius Pilate in 29 AD, and they did positively ID it. I think the man's name was Wagner, I think is his name, and, and that these coins were actually minted in 29 AD. So you put that together with the pollen, and it's like, really? And there was one other thing that was really
sounds convincing to me.
Well, it convinced me, obviously. And not, you know, this is a matter of faith, but then again, perhaps not, because, you know, there are these scientific things that you can see in it. And I think if you talk to most scientists, I'm going to say most, I do believe this to be true, they will admit there is a God. There is a God because they see it in their science. But anyway, I digress.
That's an interesting point, Linda. I'm going to add to that. I came across my desk that somebody said in the old days, you would be lucky to get 10 to 11% of scientists who would go outside the Darwin factory of evolution and say, yeah, there was some sort of great creating force or God Almighty involved. This was, you know, it's all nature, and that's how everything came to be. Well, that's now changed with the younger scientists. It used to be like 10, 11% for God as the creative force and 80 to 90% against it. Now it's the other way around. 80% or more of younger scientists believe that there was a God Almighty creator. So they have some sort of sense of faith involved in their science, which to me, that sounds like a perfect way to approach things, that there must be some creative force, something that that makes plants grow, whatever that force is, and we can call it growth for creation, whatever. But that is now shifting gears. So there's more scientists now as believers. Now, do you think that's going to help the theory and what these, I'm going to call them facts that you're putting forward? They make pretty good sense to me, but more scientists are coming on board.
Mm-hmm. I sure hope so. That's really encouraging to hear. I think the first thing I did get through several years of inorganic chemistry. I ended up with a different major, but I was pre-pharmacy for a while. So I did have a little bit of understanding of physics, et cetera. But, you know, my question always was, well, who started the Big Bang? I mean, the point where most of them had to admit that there was some higher power or something else going on. So it's good to hear that that is the case. It is obvious to me and to you anyway that's, you know, that would be so. There's so many things about this shroud that make it real to me. Another one that came up that I was reading about had to do with when people were crucified and they were taken down in haste the way Christ was, they were, you know, pretty, you know, gnarled up, bloody, et cetera, and they would wrap the face to, you know, so people wouldn't see how horrible they looked, and they would turn them in a certain way so that the blood would drip down. And there's a face cloth, and I believe it's in Oviato, I think that's how you pronounce it, back in the 600s. And they had that particular cloth there. It's there, I guess, now. It's all the way up till present. And apparently it has the same blood markings, the same everything. It matches in 124 different blood stains to match the shroud. How you do that, I do not know. You cannot paint that. I'm sorry, I don't believe that. So, you know, you have the shroud, and then you have this face cloth. You have also blood evidence, which, you know, blood is not a dye or a paint. So they were able to test. They were able to get only partial DNA because the thing had been handled so much, it probably was contaminated. But they did get an AB positive blood type. And they did get that it was a male. So that's very, very helpful.
Well, as I understand that face cloth, Linda, it was, and part of the faith, part of the process, that the reason the face was wrapped in a cloth, it wasn't by chance, it was part of the burial process. That was to stop the blood from leaking away. It was to keep the blood in with the integrity of the body. And because the blood was very precious, that no blood should go onto the ground kind of thing. In some of my researches in the past, that was a very important step to wrap the face. So not to hide it from view because it would be construed and tortured. I mean, this body that was there has some other peculiarities in it. The legs were not broken. The legs in normal crucifixion, the convict's legs were broken, so they couldn't stand up on that nail and breathe because the position of being on a cross is that you slowly suffocate. And there were ropes used so that in order to prolong the death, they would pull the person up and over the T-bar or the cross so they could get their breath, and then they would let them hang there some more. So this body in the shroud didn't have broken legs, but it had all the other markings of being frailed and whipped. And the cloth that you were referring to, I heard the story too, that it was identical. It was like the features on the cloth matched the features on the shroud. And yet here they are, two distinct, and I think found at different times, garments that were identical to this person. We're going to call him Jesus in the shroud. So just to give you a little bit of information on that the reason the face was, the head was wrapped, was that they were attempting to preserve the blood, that it shouldn't leak out or be wasted. And then again, you know, how did that imprint get onto those garments, those cloths? How did that happen? What do you find out?
My understanding is that they did wrap the face, and I'm glad you added that. I didn't know that. And then I assume they placed him in the tomb and unwrapped that, put it on the side, which I believe the face cloth, it said in the scriptures that there was something on a face cloth on the side, and wrapped him in the linen and laid him in the tomb there.
Did they wash the body a little bit when it was in the chamber? I don't know. Just asking. Did they wash the body?
I don't think that they touched it. I think that there was no time, as I recall. But
Sun was going down or something.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Exactly. It was Passover. It was Passover, just as it Passover was yesterday, as I recall. So So they were trying to. It wasn't just the High Holy Day. It wasn't just the. You know, the Sabbath, it was a very holy Sabbath. So they had to rush him into that tomb and get him down off of there. And, of course, as you know, he was pierced in the side. He didn't have broken legs. He was already dead. So they pierced him in the side around in the fifth or sixth rib and made a hole in there. And apparently those wounds, you know, fluid, not necessarily water, but it was a clear fluid and blood came out of Jesus's body. And it actually, you can see the spirit self is the same size as the wound on the garment. So it's really, really interesting. And as you pointed out, the nails that were put in or were put through the wrist and through the ankles not the way we see it pictured in church through the palms of the hand or the middle of the feet. The whip marks were there. All of those things that were typical, were being used, were not typical of what they were doing to a regular crucifixion, were there. Not like a normal one anyway. I don't think that could have been forged. I think that would be too difficult. The other thing is about the blood, from what I was reading, serum blood dries. It dries around the wound, and it separates outward, and you have the red in the middle and the liquid on the outside. All of the serum that's separated on this cloth is vertically transferred and vertically, pointing down, which, actually makes you think that of someone hanging on a cross. So that's just one more thing.
Well, to a skeptic person, everybody's skeptical when you first come across things like this. The first thing is, if somebody was making a forgery, they made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah.
They made a lot of mistakes. So who would make a forgery with all these mistakes? And so in reverse, looking at that, the proof is there that they didn't make it so perfect. If it was a forgery, they overlooked a lot of things that only the body of the Christ or this whatever made the imprint on the shroud, whatever that was, had to be holy. Now, the other thing is that, as you alluded to earlier, when somebody's put a cloth over top of them, it's like a pancake. This had a three-dimensional photographic kind of image on or in the shroud. How did that happen? Any theories on that?
Oh, sure. There's always a number of them on that. Actually, the one I read, and let me back up and just also mention about the blood. When they did the testing, they found something called ferrins, which is an enzyme that only is present under severe stress. And that is certainly, again, not something that an artist could actually fabricate at this point. But getting back to the 3D image, yeah, I know. There's just too much to disregard the fact that this is real. This is really real. It's an opportunity for those people who are like Thomas, who actually need to see the nail in the hand, or the nail in the wrist in this case. This is your proof. This is your opportunity. But
I can, what comes to me, Linda, I can only wonder what it's going to be like the next time the Vatican allows this garment to be examined with the high digital cameras that we have. I mean, we can look out into the faraway galaxies and it's like we're taking a picture across the street. I wonder what kind of photography or investigation is going to come up when we go down in these lower levels, get down to these minute details that are already there as far as I'm concerned. I'm convinced. I'm a skeptical guy. I've looked at it, and I'm sure everybody who has an interest looking at it would see some peculiar aspects of it that don't fit. And then listening to what you've had to say tonight, this is dynamite for anybody who wants evidence. I mean, people who reject it out of hand and they don't look at it, well, they don't count. That's just silly. But I wonder what it's going to be like the next time that they're going to have a look. Any plans for that to happen, by the way?
I don't know. I didn't look that up. But I would think, I'm sure the Vatican's very protective of this particular piece. They have their own scientists, of course, through the Jesuit section. But it's very interesting indeed. The way they said that this particular image was formed is very interesting. And the different researchers that I've read about say that it's formed by light, or basically ultraviolet light. I should be more specific, and ultraviolet light radiation, several billion watts. And it also, the 3D elements of it, they speak of saying that the mechanical, the body itself went transparent. It was a tenth of or a billionth of a second that this was actually, this light was actually put through this cloth. And then the body became transparent, and that's when this light also captured that 3D image of the bones, et cetera. Several billion watts. That's a billionth of a second to make all of this happen. There is not enough power on the planet you know, be it lasers or anything, or ultraviolet, whatever, to actually produce this image in this fashion. So that is a miracle in my mind of light and of spirit, the fact that, and you know, in the Gospels, they talked about Jesus walking through walls. And that's, you know, very interesting. So how did that happen? And what does that mean? And how was he transfigured? How was he, you know, how was he, you know, how did the resurrection happen? And that you always think about that when you look at the shroud. So,
well, I think you have to now go to the next level of getting involved into the soul consciousness and the spiritual body of the Christ. It's recorded, and you know, you haven't quite got there yet, but, you know, like some of the other prophets in the Bible, in the Old Testament, they were so, they pleased God so much that they took their body with them. And it's not the first time that somebody has, you know, done so well spiritually that they've had this spiritual experience. They became so self-realized that when they passed on, they were called home and they took their body with them. And so the idea of this eventuality that we all might have or share sometime, some way, if we become spiritually perfect, if I can use that term, that at that point that when Jesus' soul was able to move around, it would be, you know, I'm like ghost people, right? They go through walls. Spirits are able to go through what we would call matter because they're not of the same vibration. And it would make perfect sense that we have a master who was reported that when he was alive, being able to walk on water and being able to transform fishes and loaves into multiples of the same, so much so that there were 7 baskets of scraps left over when they started out with 1 or 2 baskets of fish and loaves in the beginning. So we start to lean over to the spiritual understanding that the soul was so self-realized that it took the body, and I've heard a theory, maybe you would agree, where the atoms of the body separated, and it was like a nuclear explosion or something like that happening. The atoms separated, and that's why the body, I'm going to say, it just separated, and that's why it floated through the garment. And then later on, when he appeared on the road, some of his disciples came up to touch him, and I think one of the ladies out outside the tomb went to touch him, and he said, "Don't touch me. I've not been made whole yet." When I heard that, that's when this theory that he was still in a translucent, semi-connected on an atomic level, you know, we're talking now into, mechanics and quantum mechanics and things like that. It's now starting to make sense. But again, if it was a story, who would make up such a story? And then the idea you have these proofs or these recounts of this being, Jesus the Christ, and then you start to put it together with, we're now talking about the spiritual or the soul consciousness, which of course is Jesus the Christ, you know, the fully realized spiritual being he was and is, makes sense that he could not only go through his shroud, but he could walk through walls. And how did he get the big door open? That's the question. Stay tuned, everybody. We're going to take a short break and be right back with how Jesus got that door open. We'll be right back after this.
Every so often, an individual appears who can demonstrate the ability to access the dimension known as the Akashic Field. Dr. Douglas James Cottrell is one such individual. The field is like a celestial library of all our thoughts and actions since the dawn of time. Science is demonstrating that through this energetic field, our minds are connected to one another despite our perception that we're all separate. This is why the great religions of the world teach respect, compassion, and tolerance. They depict the field as the book of life, the source of inventions, inspiration, and insight. In the book, Conversations with the Akashic Field, Dr. Cottrell offers you practical advice from the Akashic Field so you may live a life of peace and prosperity. Go to DouglasJamesCottrell.com and click on Shop. There you'll find books, meditation, and other spiritual advancement materials. Did you know that Dr. Douglas Cottrell has several other weekly channels where you can participate? Check out his Sunday International Spiritual Healing Service on Zoom, plus a Wednesday night Zoom community gathering. And you might also enjoy the Wake Up Podcast, exploring human consciousness, awareness, and intuition with Dr. Douglas and co-host Les Hubert. Just go to douglasjamescottrell.com and message us on the contact page to add your name to the Zoom links of your choice. You're listening to the Global Village International Radio Show with your host, Dr. Douglas James Cottrell. Call in and ask a question about tonight's topic at area code 718-766-4421. That's 718-766-4421. Now, once again, here's Dr. Douglas James Cottrell.
Well, isn't it a dynamite show tonight, my friends? As we promised, before we go to talk to our co-host, Doug Bentley, I'll introduce him in a moment or two. We asked Linda before the break about how did Jesus move the tombstone. That seemed to be a concern at the time. It was apparently guarded by Roman soldiers as well. And that's one of those mysteries of the Bible that if there was any fakery, if there was something that wasn't divine influence, how did that giant tombstone, which was rolled into place, I understand it might have weighed a ton, how did it get moved out? And the only person there was Jesus. He was inside. He was visited by angels, we're told that. The guards outside didn't get paid off. They weren't asleep. They certainly would have heard if a gang of grave robbers had come along or devotees had come along to move the stone. Think about that, my friends. So, Linda, I ask you, any research on how that tombstone was moved?
I don't have any research on that, but I can tell you what I believe. I do believe that angels angels moved that stone away.
Makes sense.
In the Bible, they basically say that he can call on legions of angels, and he probably did call on angels to help him move that stone away.
And then, Linda, why did he need the stone moved? So he could walk out. Think about that. Nobody's ever said that to me. It just occurred to me when you were talking right now.
Yeah.
So he could take his physical body and walk out of the place. Think about that, my friend. That just occurred to me as Linda was talking just now. Anyway, that was kind of like, and I was pushing the envelope that asking you that hard question about how it got done, but it was a good answer. He had help, but he had help from the divine kind.
He did have help. And I just want to add one thing, if I could. You talked about translucence and spirit body, but there's also physics in this. Light, and I do believe this is definitely a miracle of light and spirit. Light is both a wave and a particle, which means it can be measured and move in those two different areas. And so this translucentness, this phasing, if you will, in and out of a particular frequency or whatever, is perhaps where this is going at the atomic level, like you were discussing. So anyway, that's all. The shroud confirms the resurrection in my mind.
Well, here we are on, this is called Good Friday, and I don't want anybody to get me wrong on this, but I don't think it's good at all. This was a day in which Jesus the Christ was murdered, crucified, executed. It was a day that he had suffered immensely, and the people who were responsible for his death were jealous of him. They were attempting to stop him because they thought he was going to take over their religious organizations or that he was some threat to their belief system. He had his enemies. And all this man did, this Jesus the Christ did, was to help people all of his life. And in a way of showing us that he took on all the sins for the world. And it's been recorded or spoken about in other prophecies and other predictors of the future in other cultures, that there would come a man and the weight of all the sins of all the human, the world, the human people in the world, they would fall on this one man and he would resolve their sins. And he often spoke about that. He knew he was going to be arrested, tortured, tried, and executed. If you read the good book, you'll find that he was predicting that when he saw the Greeks in Jerusalem, that he knew that was near his time, and he fainted on the road. He was just, his knees buckled because he knew what was coming up. He predicted these things to his disciples and to the followers. He knew what was going to happen to him. Now, that makes sense that a divine being would be able to prophesize and see the future and know what was going to happen. But he also knew why it was going to happen and that he changed the world. For better, for worse, for greater, for lesser, whatever your opinion is, my friends, this man came into the world in a rough time. The country was occupied by brutes. The Romans were brutish. It came into a time of great corruption. It came into a time when the religious factions were infighting and there was turmoil and the people were suffering. The poor people were excluded. The people that were included were the rich and the ones that were, let's say, wealthy or privileged. Orphans and widows were like kickbags. There was no protection for them. That's how crude this time was. But this man came along, and he knew what was going to happen to him. He forecast, he told people what was going to happen, and then he also told them the reason, that the Son of Man will be risen on the third day. Think of that, my friends. Think, here you are at this point in time, this Good Friday. How would you be? How would you, if you were there and you knew that there was your best friend was down the street held in prison and he was being whipped with cat of nine tails with little hooks in them, lashes, and that he ultimately was going to be strung up on a cross, how would you feel? Well, we know the story. They ran away. His friends betrayed him. They denied him. He was all alone. But still, he continued on with his mission. And from that day to this, we celebrate not this Good Friday as a day that is good, but it's a day of great sadness. But it's hope for us because this day is the day that Jesus the Christ took the wayward direction of the humans upon the world, the sins, if you will, sin meaning being off the mark, and he took it upon himself. Our co-host Doug Bentley is going to come up next and he's going to talk about the name of Jesus. It's not really Jesus, you know. He's going to talk about it in a moment, and I'm going to let Linda finish her comment about, think about how important this man was and what happened to him and how his soul, this consciousness of this man, was still here after he was executed. You talked about him walking through walls and going places, Linda. And we alluded to the fact that he was met on the street and they, you know, doubting Thomas, I think. What's the story behind that one? I always thought that was funny when I heard it in Sunday school.
I hope I remember it well here. Basically, they were in the upper room. They were all talking. They were, had said they had seen Jesus. Thomas had come in after that, and Jesus reappeared to him and said, Thomas, you know, look at my hands, put your hand in my side, and blessed are those who don't see and who believe, I think is what he said, and then he disappeared, I think. I have to go back and look it up in the Bible,
Linda, I was thinking he stuck his hand in the wound.
He did.
You know, he put his finger.
yeah. He did. He did because he couldn't quite believe it. And there are a lot of people in that particular position. And that's why this shroud is important from a scientific standpoint, because for all those people who are doubting Thomas's, the shroud offers that piece of evidence, that next step that they need to be able to believe that Jesus really is the Christ and really came to save us. Now there's a second coming, and I think that second coming for Israel and for the Jews will be the Jesus that they will recognize. Unfortunately, they did not recognize Jesus when he came.
I've talked to people in many cultures and many faiths, and everybody agrees. I shouldn't say everybody, because how do I know what everybody agrees? But for most of the people I've had discussion with, there's a consensus that Jesus the Christ was a divine being. And sometimes he's called a great prophet, sometimes called the Messiah, sometimes called Rabbi, sometimes called Jesus the Christ. And Doug's going to get to the name that is the meaning behind his name that he came with. And so he was a divine being. There's no two ways about it. But the point is that we all come to that faith, that moment of faith ourselves some way, somehow. But he was real. He did come. And he was predicted of coming into the world. Angels welcomed him into the world. Angels were there at his tomb. And it was Zebedee who took the body down from the cross, wrapped him in this cloth, and put him in his tomb. Zebedee owned the big ships that the disciples used to go across the Sea of Galilee on. There was a community there. But Jesus was taken like a criminal. He was arrested and he was beaten. And the mock trial he went through, the judge even said, "Don't you understand we have the power of life and death over you?" Because he hadn't spoken until that point. And his reply was, "You don't have the power of life and death over me. Only my Father in heaven does," meaning God. And so he showed us he was a human being all the way along. But the one thing that he showed us by his demonstration, which changed the world, is the resurrection. Everybody thinks that Judas was a pretty bad guy. He was. He betrayed his best friend, his teacher. But somebody once said to me, "If it wasn't for Judas, we never would have heard of Christ." Now, that's a pretty broad statement. But the idea was that it was Judas that orchestrated the arrest of Christ. He fingered him out. Remember, he kissed him on the cheek. Kiss of death. Okay, and I'm going to give a shout out to our friend Jack, who came up with this the other day. And I'll put it out to you, my friends. When in history did everybody in the known world have to go home? When anybody in the known world, when were they required to go home and stay home? Well, if you're questioning, what am I talking about? We know that at the time of the birth of Christ, Emmanuel, that Gabriel came and told Mommy Mary that she was going to have a little baby and give him his name and said he was going to be special, and she accepted that task. That they were on their way home, as everybody else was, to pay taxes or to do the census or whatever the Roman Empire demanded of them. Everybody in the known world was required. So when in history has that happened since? Never. Until COVID came along. And now everybody had to go home and stay home because the government ordered us to do so. So God bless Jack, who came up with this notion. If everybody had to stay home and then the Christ came, I know everybody's ahead of me now because you're all intuitive, and we had to go home just a couple of years ago, does that mean that the Messiah is returning? I kind of think it does. What do you think, Linda?
I believe it does, but there are signs all over the place that may be the case. There's something else that you may want to consider thinking about, you know, with regards to the Shroud of Turin and the different miracles that were going on. I was thinking about this as well, and that is there are two other times when you know, spiritual, you know, realm was called into play. One was the resurrection of Lazarus, and the other one, which was really akin to the resurrection of Jesus, was the transfiguration, the fact that he was there with Moses and Elijah, and it was obviously a different frequency or a different place, and the apostles were actually having a view into this. But just a thought. But those two in the Shroud of Turin and the resurrection itself, of course, which is the most glorious, you know, are things to think about when you're looking at that wave and that particle and the light and the miracle that happened so many years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we go to the phones, and we'll ask, we have Carol in Chicago and Kimberly in Seattle, and we have a couple of other people in between. The number to call, my friends, is 718-766-4421. I'd like to introduce my co-host, Doug Bentley. Everybody knows he's been on the show here with me through thick and thin, and tonight we've asked him to make a special report. So I want to introduce Doug like now. So, you know, as we know, Doug is a retired educator, and he's a minister at Many Mansions Spiritual Church. But Doug has spent several years researching the intricacies of language and its impact on the understanding of our religious figures and texts. So tonight, Douglas is going to give us an insight into the name Yeshua and the other names that Jesus has been called prior to this last world known name of Jesus, Jesus in the Spanish world. And so I want to welcome Doug to the show. Paul, make sure his mic's open, and welcome Doug, everybody. This is my good friend Doug Bentley, and welcome to the show, Doug.
Thank you very much. I was fascinated with what Linda was saying from her research on the Shroud of Turin. I just want to make a few quick comments. From a mathematical point of view, all Jesus had to do was go into the fourth dimension to appear in the room. That's from a mathematical point of view. And in terms of the blood on the shroud, it's not black, because it's, as Linda alluded to, when someone is tortured, there's a separation in the blood, and that's why the blood does not appear black. But medical experts have examined how Christ was scourged, and they came to the conclusion that his body was dying even before he went to trial, because of what his body had to go through. And it was all the more remarkable that he was able to go through the trial, walk to the Golgotha, and actually survive for the few hours that he did, considering what he went through.
He had to carry the cross too, didn't he? Mm-hmm.
Yes, he did. Yes. So that was just a comment I wanted to make, because I thought that was extremely fascinating what Linda said. I just want to talk a little bit about the name Jesus, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail because it would take up the whole show. But the Latin name for Jesus is Jesus. There was no J. There was no J in Latin language, and as you referred to, the name was Yeshua. Well, there's no SH in Latin either, and many of the male names in Latin end in US. Marcus Aurelius, Julius Caesar, not Julius Caesar and Marcus Aurelius. So they end in U.S. So since they didn't have a J, they put an I in front, and they put the customary male ending on the name, and that's how we got Jesus from Jesus. And, of course, on that plaque above the cross, that they nailed on Jesus' cross was the phrase "Jesus Nazarenus Rex Iudaeorum," and there's the "Jesus" right at the beginning, and basically it meant, in the vernacular, "Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Judeans." Many people think it's King of the Jews. However, Jew is a relatively recent corruption of one of the patriarchs of the Hebrew faith, which is Judah. And that's where we get the eponymous name Judaism for the faith. But it's a relatively recent corruption. And as you said, the Yeshua is in English Joshua. Now, what's interesting from an etymological point of view is that it's spelt Yod-Heh-Shin-Vav-Heh. And what is particularly interesting to me is this Hebrew sacred name for God, the Tetragrammaton. We usually use the word Yahweh in English, but it's spelled Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Now, if you look at the spelling for Yeshua and what we refer to as Yahweh, and of course this was a sacred name, it was never spoken, so there's no historical understanding of what the correct way is, because they just didn't pronounce it. But if you look at Yeshua as it is spelt, the first two letters are Yod, Hey, and the last two letters of Vav He. That's the Tetragrammaton, the spelling for Yahweh or Jehovah. And what's the significance of that? Well, obviously the Tetragrammaton, the name for the Hebrew God, is part of the name. But the Shin is particularly interesting because it's symbolic, or it represents spirit descending into matter or flesh. So from my perspective, that is extremely significant for Jesus. It represents the Spirit of God descending into the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I'm going to stop.
Well said, Douglas. Well said. Listen, my friends, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back, and we're going to get you to participate in the show. And we'll let you call in and ask questions to Linda, or if you have a comment to Douglas. And that will be the time. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back after this.
For many years, clairvoyant seers have had the ability to peer into the Akashic field and see the library of information for every thought, deed, and action of souls living on the physical earth plane. One of four such individuals, Dr. Douglas James Cottrell, trained under the direction of Ross Peterson, who, just like Edgar Cayce, was able to diagnose and provide guidance for physical and other problems encountered in daily life. One of Douglas's many books, The Complete New Age Health Guide, is a plentiful resource from thousands of clairvoyant readings. You'll learn how thought, emotion, and attitude influence your physical health, keys to anti-aging, the simple ways to a good life and diet, and so much more. Take a look at the New Age Health Guide, on sale now at DouglasJamesCottrell.com.
Who is God?
What's my purpose?
What do my dreams mean?
What are miracles?
What are spiritual abilities?
Was I in a past life?
Who is my soulmate?
What is meditation?
Are your thoughts racing around on what life is or how to live it? Slow down. Find answers in Dr. Douglas James Cottrell's book, Secrets of Life, now available at DouglasJamesCottrellStore.com or Amazon.
Are you ready to experience life-changing wisdom, spiritual insights, and transformative knowledge? Come to the Next Hope Conference, May 26th through the 28th in Phoenix, Arizona. Powerful healing techniques and spiritual practices for personal growth. Interactive questions and answers with Douglas James Cottrell and other experts. Insights into global events and predictions through a spiritual lens. At Hope Conferences, we believe in the power of spiritual growth and transformation. Our mission is to bring together like-minded individuals and provide them with the tools and knowledge they need to unlock their full potential and answers to help you with future events. Join us in Phoenix, Arizona, May 26th through the 28th in Phoenix, Arizona. Go to hopeconferences.org. That's hopeconferences.org to register now. You're listening to the Global Village Radio Show with your host, Dr. Douglas James Cottrell. Tonight, talking about the Shroud of Turin. Now, here's your host, Dr. Douglas James Cottrell.
And welcome back to the show, my friends. It's a dynamite show tonight. I hope you're wondering and thinking, and maybe you have a question or two you'd like to call and ask Linda about her researches and what she's found out about the Shroud of Turin. The number to call is 718-766-4421. Looks like we're going to head out to Seattle, and then we're going to head over to Chicago and talk to our friend Carol over there in a few moments. But as we get to this point, Linda, can you remember the first time you came upon the Shroud and what your feelings or sense or thought was? I mean, as people out there listening in the audience right now, maybe they're skeptical, maybe they're believers, maybe they want to know more about it. What was your reaction, or can you remember that? I kind of remember mine. That's why I'm asking you. What did you think when you first saw it?
A very long time ago, when I was probably in my, probably 1978-ish, when they started doing the testing, and it was all over the news that was going on. I was wondering about it, and I read articles about it, and then I think I purchased a couple of books, and I read more about it. I was not really a practicing Christian at that point. So it helped me understand the resurrection, or at least how horrible it was. Mm-hmm. And, it led me to a beginning path, if you will, of becoming a Christian. And, so it was probably back in 78. Oh my gosh, am I that old? Yes, I am.
No. It was 87. There's a little dyslexia going on there with, you know, make it later. I think it is one of those things.
You were a very young child, Linda.
There you go.
I was a very young child. There you go. That's it.
Yes.
But it was a teenager.
Well, even still, you know, it's kind of people who not anything to anything other than people who are younger who come to investigating spiritual things, get little nudges from the cosmos. I think we're all ready, we're all ready to learn, and that the angels that are around us, they give us a little nudge every now and then. And sometimes when we're younger, we are interested in motorcycles and drive-in theaters, and now we're interested in TikTok and all kinds of different distractions that are going on. But there's that theme never goes away. And then it's interesting, when you kind of come to the faith, it's not really, I teach that faith isn't something in believing of an invisible man behind a curtain. That's kind of, some people believe it, and some, they teach it, and people believe the way that gets taught. But I believe faith is a process, and it's a matter of coming to believing your faith because you have evidence of your beliefs. And when you have evidence of your beliefs, well, then you naturally have faith. And so what we're talking about tonight is evidence. We're talking about the evidence of the Shroud. How did this garment exist and continue to exist since 30 years or so after Jesus the Christ was born? Where was it put? How was it kept? Who took care of it? Who were the custodians? Who, all those things. There had to be some sort of divine protection over it so that it gives evidence. This is evidence. I know there's pieces of the cross that are supposed to have been salvaged, and there are there are wooden implements that have been, you know, authenticated as saying they could possibly be, they were made of the same wood and whatever. But this is an imprint. It has a picture. It has the stains of the face of Yeshua, Jesus the Christ. Wow. And that in itself is a miracle how it survived all these years. The devil didn't get at it. Tried to burn it down one time, but didn't get to it. So anyway, I want to thank Doug for that wonderful explanation and dissertation on the linguistics of the meaning of the words. Words have power, and that's why you should pray every day, my friends, to invoke the power of prayer. But thank you very much, Doug, for that insightful dissertation.
Well, thank you very much as well. I just want to point out one thing. Further evidence of the authenticity, which I believe is the Shroud of Christ, that there's swelling in the face and the nose is broken.
Mm-hmm. From the imprint. They were deducting this. Sure. Go ahead.
Amazing. A man who's tortured to death.
Well, as Linda and I were saying a moment ago, several moments ago, we were talking about the imprint and how is it that if this was a topical garment, it wouldn't show the bones, it wouldn't show the breakage, it wouldn't show the scars, it wouldn't show the wounds in the skin or the flesh, it wouldn't show the stains of blood. So that, Linda's, you know, is there anything other than, I was going to ask you this earlier, how big a garment was this, Linda? I mean...
Oh, it was 14 feet... a little more than that, maybe a few more inches than that. So it was enough to double over. So, yeah, it was not small.
And how wide?
Oh, I think it was about 3.5 feet.
Wow. Yeah, I understand. For people who don't know, the shroud was like laid out on a table. The body was put on top of the table, and then the shroud was folded over from the head to the feet or something like that. Is that your take on it too?
Yes, that is the case. And then there is some stories about, the face in another church, and I'm sorry I don't have the name in front of me, but this is going back before the Middle Ages, and this is part of the lost historical, but that it was actually folded up, put into a frame, and hung in a church. And that is part of the reason why you have so many different folds on this. It's not just the folding of the current, but also the folding of many, many years ago.
Right. I remember seeing it on TV in black and white where it was taken out of a chest. So, it was like a 4 foot. So I remember that it was folded up in the chest. I was just a little guy then too. So very good.
Yeah.
That's where it caught fire and the metal melted, and that's why there's holes in the shroud.
Mm-hmm. In the corners there that went through the folds. That's right. A very good point, Doug. So let's go to the phones. We have Kimberly in Seattle, and we have Carol in Chicago. Where are we going next, Paul?
We're going to start with Kimberly in Seattle, Douglas.
Well, welcome to the show, Kimberly.
Thank you. Hey, Dr. Cottrell. So I have a comment and a question. So I actually saw the shroud in person back in May of 2015 when it was in Turin, Italy.
Wow.
And so when you're meditating in front of it, it's a very profound experience. And
I was going to ask you that. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
Before I left, the Catholic Church actually calls it an icon. And what that icon means is that's a portal. And so I was told before I left that it was a portal, that the shroud knows you and you know it. So when you do meditate in front of it, it is super powerful and you go deep and you see things. And actually Jesus did come to me, and I'm not going to go into that. But
How far away from it were you, and how many people were there?
So there were just lineups of people. So they allowed you had to wait in line, and then they had you walk in single file in groups, and it was in a case, and you got to stand in front of it, and then there was pews in the church that you could go sit, and so I sat back there and directly in front of it and meditated on it.
Wow.
And so,
Kimberly,
yeah, I mean...
I've never met or spoken to anyone who's had an experience like you've had.
Yeah, it
in
was
all my
deep.
Years. Wow.
Yeah, it was deep. It was, Jesus did appear to me, and it was like he had me stand in a golden chalice, and he tapped symbols into my both of my palms. And there was white light shooting straight up into the heavens. So
where was this again?
That?
What city was this in?
In Turin, in Italy, where it's housed from the Catholic Church. And they brought it out. And they allowed the public to see it for, I think it was 2 weeks. And now they've put it away for 25 years or so.
Wow.
That was back in 2015. So
okay, 2015, 2025, 2035, let's see, 2040, I might make it.
Yeah, there you go.
I'll be 90, but
say,
I might make it.
That's funny. I was going to say to Linda's point, too, that Jesus, when he's put in that long 14-foot-long shroud, that when he was ascending, and it was radiation light, that his body actually levitated, and literally like a X-ray machine, it imbued his, you know, all of his whole entire body structure and face in there. So it imprinted it forever in that shroud. Anyway,
Okay.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I heard something that there was imprints on the roof of the I was going to say cave. Is that a tomb? I guess is the better term. That wasn't a very big place. Was it a room? But I think it was a very small place.
It was very small, and there was a hidden entrance on the side of that cave, but you could call it a tomb. And actually, there are myrrh floors inside of there, several women, and there was a few men, but more women. And on the shroud itself, there is proof from when I went in 2015, the scientists had found the myrrh oil resin on that shroud, and it did date back to the first century.
Wow.
So that is proof that the myrrh floors, the healers, were in there healing his body so he could come back into his body. Even though he was up in the heavens and he had ascended, he was coming back down into that body, and that body was ragged, ripped from foot to head with the, you know, all the shells, and if they put nails in there, I don't know what it looked like, but it was bad. It ripped him from foot to head.
Well, I know that they didn't recognize him on the road to, I was going to say Galilee, but I can't remember. He was on the highway. Pardon?
Damascus.
Damascus, yeah.
Damascus, there we go. He was on the road, and they came up to him, and they didn't recognize him. And he went over, and he said, "Don't you recognize me? I'm your rabbi." And they went, no, you know, like they were shocked. That's because he was mutilated because of his torture and what. So, yeah, very good. Okay, good point to bring that up.
So what the myrrh floors were doing was healing the body so his spirit could come back into it and that he could walk. But even though he was translucent, which is absolutely correct, and no one could touch it, because he told Mary Magdalene, you know, she was the first one to see him in the garden.
Yep.
He said, do not touch me, because basically, she could probably put her hand through him.
Yeah, I'm not made whole, I think, is the quote. Yeah.
Yeah, and so they did raindrop therapy on his body inside the tomb with the healers, with the myrrh floors.
Okay.
And I was told that the face cloth that they put on his face, there was two of them, and they did that, they said, so they could tell if he was breathing when he came back, so they could see his breath.
Okay, wow. I haven't heard that
one
before.
So that's what I was told. So just food for thought, you know, it's out there.
Sure.
So the shroud is in Italy now. The face cloth is in Spain. And I'm wondering if that face cloth has the same profound energy, and it must, as the shroud. And why? Why they separate them? Because the Templars had that shroud, you know, when they were burnt at the stake in 1307. Jacques de Molay was the Grand Master. And his friend, who, and I can't remember his name, but his wife took the shroud and her family guarded it for 400 years, and then lost track of it.
Wow. There's the answer that we asked earlier, how did that survive? The Templars had it. Well, okay, that's a pretty darn good answer. I mean, I didn't know
that. Yeah, the Templars had it, but then, just like Linda said, it is in Turkey, and it goes several places, but I don't know how it ended back, you know, in Italy, and how the face cloth ended up in Spain and how they got separated.
Well, icons are icons, and it was important to have relics. It was financially important to the organizations at the time to have relics. And that's why you have saints where they have parts of bodies that were from place to place. I'm not going to get into that because I did a lot of research in it, and there was skullduggery, you know, one church sneaking over, grabbing the bones out of another church and, you know, stuff like that. But that's a show for another day. You have a question for Linda?
Yeah. Actually, anybody, do the Akashic records talk about the Templars having the shroud and what did happen in that gap after that 400 years?
Okay, is there information about a spiritual organization called the Knights Templars? Yes, there is. It's extensive. And the Knights Templars are located in Malta, where there are secret caves and meetings that aren't so secret. And then there are speculative Templars in North America. And they follow in the speculative way the way of you know, that the meaning of the swords and the temples and things like that. In a speculative way, they apply their understandings in a spiritual concept in a moralistic way. But yes, they're around, but the Templars, the lineage, the true Templars are in Malta, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah, I was in Malta too, and that's what I saw, those cave systems. And then a quick question on the Jesus' legs not being broken. I had always heard that Joseph of Arimathea, his uncle, made a deal with Pontius Pilate that he would be able to take the body down, put it in the shroud, and take it to the cave or the tomb after. And he was only up there for 3 hours before the Passover. So legend has it that in that sponge that they put on him, that was actually some type of drug to make him look like he was dead. Yeah,
I heard that before. Yeah, that was part and parcel. Again, for everybody listening, we mentioned it earlier. Linda, you know, jump in if you feel want to. The idea that the legs were broken on the criminals was so that they couldn't push themselves up and breathe, because when you were in that position of hanging on a cross, you couldn't breathe. You suffocated slowly to death. That was the torture of it. And so Jesus' legs weren't broken. And that's why the soldier went up and stabbed him in the side with a spear, because he died too soon. They couldn't believe he was dead. And that happened after the sponge was given to him. And great controversy over first of all, he asked for water, begged for water, and then they gave him vinegar. And the good cover story, and for the conspiracy people, you know, it would be a perfect time to give Jesus a narcotic that would knock him out. That he would not have to suffer anymore. And then there's other conspiracies about, well, did he really die or not? But we're not going to go there.
He wouldn't suffer, because he, with all of his advanced skills, would be able to go out of his body and do things. One angel did say, why are you looking for the dead among the living? Meaning he's still alive. So the shroud's very interesting. The mirror force are fantastic, and what they did or able to do in the 3 days it took them. And so I want to go to Spain to see the face cloth, and it's in the crypt, and you have to make a special appointment.
Linda, have you heard about that there was a relic in Spain?
Yes, I have heard of it, but I don't have the details as much as she does. You know, all the things that happened around Jesus's crucifixion fulfilled prophecy about not breaking you. Not a bone in his body will be broken.
Yes.
All kinds of things. You know, the entrance into Jerusalem, all of that, you know, the birth of Christ, even in Bethlehem, the house of David, etc. There's, hundreds and hundreds of prophecies about the Christ, and they all came together in Jesus, and it all came together on that cross. So, I wish I knew more about it. I'm just like everyone else seeking, but I did do, would love to go to Spain myself.
I'd like to see the face cloth.
Well, our Hope Conferences, I get a little plug in for that. We are starting a worldwide mission, and we will be returning to Spain, Linda and Kimberly. My impromptu visit to Spain years ago, I started off in San Sebastian in the north, or the Tale of Tears. I went to, I went to Madrid next, and then I went to Barcelona, and then I went a little further south to Sevilla and Granada. And so I crisscrossed Spain. I went west to from Madrid as well, and I can't remember the name of the city there. It was Como or something like. Anyway, I made a big X or a cross on Spain, and one of the most amazing memories I had was going up in Barcelona, north of Barcelona, into what they call the Five Fingers, and there was a monastery up there. You just kept going, driving up higher and higher and higher. And in my teeny tiny knowledge, my awareness about Spain, if you think about it, was almost the center of the world, you know, and things happened there that were absolutely amazing. Several installations of Roman installations, Jesus was there. There's a footprint where he stepped someplace, and they have that as a place that it was in the mud. He stepped in it, and they have that as a relic. And they find out that Jesus went to Spain a lot, and he went to other countries around the Mediterranean. We only have a little fragment of that. Why did he do that? Well, he was looking for the lost tribes. He was trying to unite the lost tribes of Israel, and that's why he was going to all these different places. But Spain is an amazingly holy, full of holy places that you have to, if you go there, everybody knows about them, of course. But for us coming from the West to go there would be, I never heard that. I didn't know that. I didn't, it was like that. And so to hear about the face cloth, or the cloth of the face of the Christ here, and also that, you know, that 2040 is the time that we can all make it over there, and they're going to pull up the Shroud of Turin again. I'll keep that in mind, you know.
Yeah.
If I don't get forgetful at 90, but I'll keep that in mind. Thank you for that. So
yeah, and also the Templars were in Spain too. They have cathedrals over there that they built, and they formed over there as well.
I think they were
lots
everywhere.
Of land from the king and queen.
Yeah, I think they were everywhere, and there's, you know, Columbus and the Crusades and also the conquistadors in South America. There's all that intrigue going on, but at Queen Isabella and the other kings and queen, they were thinking worldly, and why were they doing that? You know, well,
yeah.
That's a question for another show. But thank you, Kimberly. Appreciate
you
coming on and giving us such an enlightenment. Of information, and the questions were very nicely suited for the show. Linda,
thanks for having me.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, and stay in touch. Okay. Thank you, Kimberly. Paul, where are we going next?
Going to Chicago, and Carol is on the line. Douglas,
welcome to the show, Carol. Good to have you back again. How are you?
Okay.
I should have said Happy Easter to Kimberly. I'll give her a belated one here now, and I'll wish you a Happy Easter too, Carol, in advance. Good to have you back on the show.
Yeah, I was going to wish everybody else a Happy Easter. I was thinking about that. The Knight Templar in the Middle Ages, I guess they secretly guarded the Turin. Then wasn't it given to the House of Savory, and then to somebody called, I think, Umberto II of Italy in 1983, I think.
Kimberly?
I think.
It was 1453 when the ownership of the Shroud transferred to Duke of Savory in Geneva. At least that's the research that I have on that. So that does sound correct, yes.
Was it in the 1500s or?
It was 1453.
15th century.
And I got one question. Because what I noticed about it, those blood stains, you know, to be that old, it was still reddish. And a lot of people don't think that they're real because they said that he would have been a blood type O. Because he would have been a universal donor. And one lady, she was arguing about he would have been a universal donor, and that it was fake because they didn't find any hemoglobin in him. But yes, they did. They found all those things in it. So.
Okay.
But my question is about the blood stains. Are they still reddish? When you saw them, when somebody saw them, were they, you know, reddish when they saw them?
The photographs that I've seen seem to be that color, but it's very, very, very faded, very faint. What they did, the test that they did on the blood actually did show hemoglobin. They did show AB positive, and that was the common blood type in that part of the world at the time. So, and actually, I think if you go over there, it still is. In Judea, in Israel, et cetera, AB positive, which is still a pretty rare blood type, I should say. So, again, that's just one more point that points to the validity of the shroud.
Can I have that again, Linda? That was AB positive?
AB positive. That's what the test, and they did the test, and they determined that it was AB positive.
Would AB negative be even more rare, or would that be less rare?
Yes.
You changed your voice, Linda. What happened?
Yeah.
Got
know,
deeper all
know,
of a sudden.
She's versatile.
So is AB negative more rare than AB positive?
I would guess. Yeah, I think Doug's right. But O is the most common blood type. I know that much because that's the type I have.
Yeah, I've heard that O goes all the way back to Neanderthal time, and that there was a friend of mine who wrote a book called Eat for Your Blood Type. There was a chiropractor I know, and I won't say his name, but because he's private, and he had done a lot of research on that, and then that book came out, Eat Right for Your Blood Type, and that's where I found out people with low blood. I'm going to say something funny here. People with O type blood, they can eat anything. They could eat spark plugs and it wouldn't bother them. So that blood type O is like guaranteed, you know, you can eat anything. And not to get ahead of Carol's question, but is that true? Can, you know, you can basically have a good digestion, you can eat anything? Carol?
Yes.
Or Linda?
It's true for me. I don't know about anybody else. But.
Well, that's the answer I'm looking for because I'm jealous because I'm a
what
B
do you put
type.
With the spark plugs? That's what I'd like to know. Can make them.
Yeah,
out.
Well,
no,
that goes. The farmers have had their animals eat spark plugs that were found out in the field, but I may be negative. I think I'm not sure, but I may be anyway. And so that's where I was asking about that.
And that's why a lot of people believe that. Jesus was a blood, had a blood type O. That's why they believe it, that he had a blood type O.
But it appears that the DNA or the research says he's AB. So we're not making any proclamations here, Carol. I mean, Carol's on the show then all the time. Carol has some really great questions. And so we're not making a proclamation here tonight for anybody listening. We're talking about our ongoing research into attempting to amplify what we already tend to believe, but we're open-minded to any kind of new information. And so what we're telling everybody or broadcasting here tonight is to the best of our ability, this is what we found out to be the truth. And the whole purpose is, this is Good Friday. It's I think it's one of the most important celebrations of the year, at least in my faith as a Christian. I'm a practicing Christian, have been all my life, and I explore the mysteries of the Christ, and there's a lot of mysterious organizations that go around them, like the Knights Templar and the Rosicrucians and different people who have examined seriously the mysterious aspects and teachings of Jesus the Christ. And so I've been intrigued with that, as we are tonight. And Linda has a wealth of information here tonight about the Shroud. I've learned quite a bit. But anyway, it's your question, Carol. What else would you like to know?
And you know what that Shroud and his life reminds me of? Jesus, he was the last prophet of the Jews. And to me, he was the light. He is the light on the path of enlightenment. And, you know, he teaches many, in my opinion, that if you watch your words, thoughts, and deeds, you could have a, you could do what he did. You know, he is an example of what you can become, all that he had gone through that you can see, and he is a perfect example of what you can become.
I agree. He's the light.
More proof to me. He is the light. He is the light on the path of enlightenment. He is.
Yep. I think we can all aspire, and we should aspire, to the best of our abilities to, as he said, follow in his footsteps or follow his path, follow the way. And that doesn't mean that you had to be different. You know, we all live in different cultures and different parts of the world. We didn't have to all convert to what the way he lived his life, which was basically somebody who traveled a lot, somebody who was humble, and somebody who took on politicians and was doing miracles and things like that, and devoted his entire life to teaching while he was alive. And his teachings were not only through being an auto, through oratory, they were also through the demonstrations of his miracles, the mystery side of the Christ. And somebody once said to me, I think it was a Baptist minister, said, why do you think miracles were allowed? And I said, what do you mean allowed? And he said, well, what's the purpose of a miracle publicly? And he said, because miracles demonstrate that he had authority, but also that there is God, and God produces miracles, which are accelerated healing, if you will, at warp speed almost. But there's a process for it, and we can examine that. Sometimes it's accelerated gradually. In other words, if somebody would have a wound that would take 2 weeks to heal, it would take 3 days to heal. Other people would have the wound or the bone that was broken healed up instantly. That would be more biblical in the understanding of miracles in that sense. But what were they doing? Why were they there? Well, it's to demonstrate that there is this invisible force in our church at the International School of the Prophets. You can go there and tag and get onto our Zoom Sunday services. We call that invisible force virtue, which is the name Jesus referred to when there was a lady who had a spontaneous healing in a crowd that happened to reach out and touch him. So that's the name of this invisible healing force. But the point being is that Jesus came and demonstrated these things, and the miracles we talk about all the time, you know, fishes and loaves made from basically a few loaves and a few fish, and they filled them, fed a multitude, walked on water, told the boys when they were fishing, hey, the fish are on the other side of the boat, put your nets down here, and sure enough, they loaded up the fish. He calmed the storms down. He told the wind to behave itself, and everybody was remarking, what manner of man is this? He can command the storms and the wind to stop and be peaceful. He was showing us this dominance over the world that we all possess to some varying degree, but more importantly, he was establishing himself as an example for us to do like he did. He often said, you want to be like me? Pick up your cross and follow me. What does that mean? Well, it didn't mean you had to be tortured and go to the cross and be executed. It meant that you had to stand up as a spiritual person, in this case a Christian, and people would basically do bad things to you. They would do whatever they did to him, they would do to you. You know, call you names, doubt you, call you sinner, call you demon worshiper, whatever, if you did the same things he did, which is basically the mystical side, the healings, the generosity, the compassion, the interpreting of dreams, to have angels show up and talk to you, and on and on and on it goes. So what it comes down to, this the situation is saying, on tonight, this night of all nights, where this hallowed man stood his ground, didn't run away, knowing that was going to befall him in the oncoming hours. Those little barbed things, that's frailing, I think it's called, they're called, that used to take snips of flesh out of the body, and he was whipped profusely. I remember there's a story where Pilate came to see him, and there he was all bloody and beat up. They just expected to give him a few lashes of the whip and throw him out the gates, but when they came back, the torturers, the soldiers, or whatever they were, the guards, prison guards, they beat him up, and to the point that Pilate was shocked at this. So there's all these stories, as Carol, as Linda had said, that all these, this evidence building up. And your question tonight, Carol, is, how do we know what he is and what he was and where he was going? Well, if we follow his example, we're going to find out. But I don't think we're going to be beat up. What do you think, Linda? I think we can avoid that one.
Oh, I wish, I hope, I pray. But, whenever you stand up for truth, there's always someone there who may not agree with you. So stand firm, move forward, know that if you're in the right, God is going to be there with you, and he will defend you. He will defend you. So I have no fear in that.
Yeah, I think he was saying, too, is if you follow whatever religion you are, whoever you are, if you follow that golden rule, you'll get through it. If you follow the golden rule, you'll get through it, no matter what religion you are. Dr. Cottrell, you taught me that.
Well, you're very welcome, and that's very true. All the world's great religions, all their teachings, can be reduced to one simple statement, all of them. And there is in the Vatican, there is a poster that somebody produced taking all the world's major religions, and they're saying, which is the golden rule. It's said a little bit differently because of interpretation or words, but they all say the same thing, which is basically, for if you want to be a spiritual being, whether you believe in one religion or not, one way or not, one path or not, the only thing that you need to do, even if you don't have a religion, is not required, okay? To be spiritual doesn't mean you have to have a religion, my friends, in my opinion. The thing is just to be somebody that will not do anything to anyone else that you wouldn't want to happen to yourself. And if you follow that principle, I can guarantee you, from my limited knowledge, that you won't get in trouble, that you'll always be bailed out. When you get into trouble, like the car runs out of gas, or there you need a few dollars, or you need some clothes, or you need some directions, or you need a job, or you need some help somehow, you will always be watched over. And you will always, always, always receive a blessing. And again, just simply being nice and not doing anything to anyone else, saying about anything about anyone else, rumoring about anyone else, belittling, criticizing, whatever, being vindictive, whatever, whatever, whatever. If you don't do those things, that is to say the things that you do not want to happen to yourself, you're on the path. And you're moving forward at an accelerated rate. And you might not even know it. But anyway, Carol, you're welcome to that. Thank you very much for bringing that up. It's a question that I'm asked most often. What about, sin? What about the karma? What about this? And how come somebody's doing something and they're getting away with it and I'm suffering and I'm trying to do a good thing and everybody's taking advantage of me, et cetera, et cetera. And it comes down to that simple rule. That doesn't mean that you get pushed around, my friends. If somebody's taking advantage of you, even if they're your best friend, you tell them to stop. That's what that saying in the Bible is, if your right hand offends you, cut it off. Oh my gosh, that's gory. But what it really means is if your best friend is offending you, then you cut it off. If you have a watch that's digging in your arm and it's uncomfortable, but it used to belong to grandma, and you want to keep it, well, you take it off. Put it in a box. You don't wear it and keep aggravating yourself. So that's what that saying means, although it sounds gruesome. But if something's offensive to you, you cut it off, you take it off, you avoid it, because what it's doing is it's stealing your peace and your harmony, and therefore you're going to be provoked. Anyway, back to the point, Carol. Thank you very much for your question. Got another last question for Linda before we go. Carol?
Carol?
Yeah, I was trying to think of like some, how would you talk to the children about the shroud? You know, if they didn't know anything about the shroud, how would you talk to them about it?
I wouldn't. Linda, I wouldn't.
No, if they ask you something about the shroud, they don't know. They didn't know very much about it. Let's put it this way: they didn't know very much about the shroud.
Okay.
And
Linda?
What would you say to them if they were fourth and fifth grade?
Amazing proof of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Of what? Who you've heard of Jesus? There's proof of it, and it's in the shroud. And I can certainly point you in the right direction to look it up yourself. But, you know, when you take a look at the imprint that is a photography, negative, actual positive, and you can actually see the body, you can see the wound, you can see the resurrection itself. It is proof of that. Lots of scientists have backed it up. And it may seem like too much to do, but it'd be well worth it. And then if you're interested, we can talk more about it, and I can, you know, perhaps we can get a book together and read about it.
Yeah, because that's a question that I know I'm going to be asked that question in a couple of weeks, trust me. So that's why I pose it to you. So I'll have my response.
Okay, well, what comes to my mind, Carol, is you can do the lead-in and say, well, you know, there's this this burial garment of this Jewish man, and a lot of people think that it's a genuine article. It's still, the jury's still out. There's always debate, but you know, an awful lot of people, a million or two people, believe it's a genuine article. And then Kimberly was on the show tonight. That's the first time I've ever communicated, spoken to, or had somebody tell me that they were able to sit, how briefly, in front of the Shroud of Turin. And that's a first for the show here tonight. I've been in other places. I've been in Poland, and I saw the picture of the Black Madonna. I've been in, I won't go through them all. I've been in places where artifacts have been there. But this, I've never had the privilege of being where the Shroud is. But to let yourself ease into that when you get asked about the Shroud is kind of like, well, it's controversial. Seems to hold up under scrutiny. The Catholic Church seems to be, holding it in great value, and millions of people all over are convinced by it. And it was on a radio show the other week there, and the lady actually said that she felt the, what we can call it, the ambience or the power of the shroud. I was going to ask you about that, Linda, when she said that. That makes sense, right? I mean, if you're sitting in front of a powerful garment like that, that there should be some feeling, some greatness or some awe. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Every time I look at the face, even though it's not the real shroud in front of me, it gives me pause, especially that face with the coins on it. It's just, I think, wow, what he did for all of us that day. Take all of that on. Amazing. It makes... Go ahead.
I was going to say, is that Jesus calling now?
I guess.
It might be Jesus from the Sunday church, you know.
And
anyway.
You know what I thought about? I thought about the shroud, what it also means is that it protects, it's like it protects him even after his death. It's a symbol of his protection even after his death, or his afterlife journey or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, the thought occurs to me to say this. At the time that Jesus died, Christians were not readily accepted. They were considered criminals. They were arrested, they were tortured, they were taken to the arena and fed to the lions. Christians in the early church were considered criminals. And they were considered insurrectionists. They were trying to take down the Roman Empire, et cetera, et cetera. That's how the Christian faith started. So anybody that thinks that, you know, the Bible stories about Jesus went to the mound and he said a big talk one day, made some fish and bread magically appear, and everybody went home satisfied, and that was the end of it. No, that was just the wisdom of his teaching and how people were beginning to resonate with him and come and follow him, because he was teaching one thing, the compassion of the Christ. No other religion up until that time ever taught compassion. And that was his main teaching, compassion and love. Again, the watch out for widows and orphans. That's the early church where that was part of their duty. So he came along and he started at the grassroots level of being compassionate to people. And he was executed because the religious people at the time thought, hey, he's got a movement going here. They're going to horn in on our business. You know, pretty soon they're going to take over our churches. There's a line in the Bible about that, and I'm not quite sure where it is, but we could look it up. But the point being is that they were actually afraid of him because the people following him were getting, the crowds were getting bigger and bigger because he was talking about the truth. And the truth was compassion and hope. That's what he taught, and he gave the people at the time hope. But the early Christians were despised and considered criminals and all the skullduggery that to get rid of this crazy sort of man in the fields talking to people, and as Pontius Pilate called them, who cares? What's the big deal? That's the story behind Barabbas and how Pontius Pilate arranged that that he would, in order to get rid of this kerfuffle within the Jewish community, he thought he'd put Jesus up in front of the worst criminal in the community and say, okay, which one am I going to reprieve and, you know, forgive? Thinking, of course, Jesus would be the guy, but the skullduggery behind that was that the organizations basically bribed a lot of people, and they got the bad people in there to choose Barabbas. And then Jesus had to go to Pontius Pilate's chagrin off to be tortured. And that's why Pilate had to wash his hands so much. He is feeling so guilty about that. So that's a little bit of a tidbit to talk about this night, which is a holy night. And really, it was a terrible, 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 terrible time. But Jesus the Christ did not run away. And if anybody takes anything away from this show tonight, and Linda has provided a lot of good information, it's don't run away. Don't do anything bad to anybody else that you wouldn't happen yourself, and you'll be just like Christ. Go ahead, Carol.
One question. What was the shroud? Was it white? Was
Carol?
The shroud white? Or
Linda?
Because I know that a friend of mine, he was saying that the Jews were buried in this, that, you know, they're usually buried in the white shroud, so that everyone is viewed the same in death, that nobody is perceived as differently because of a lack of financial resources or anything. So was his shroud white or no?
It may have been, but whatever white was back then in linen, but I don't think it was, you know, like white the way we understand snow white and bleached white and all the rest of that.
Okay.
The shroud is very, you know, just yellowed, discolored, you know, and faded, in, you know, from what I've seen in pictures. Obviously, I've not seen it in person, but amazing, amazing relic, definitely a relic. Or an
there
icon.
You go.
And she was right. It was an icon. It is called an icon, but it's much more than that for me.
Yeah, it's how we touch back to the past, Linda, right? There's something. There it is. There was, you know, the man Jesus the Christ and Yeshua, if we will, to call him by his proper name. And we can,
yeah. It's
like we're right there. We can touch our faith. So anyway, thank you very much, Carol, for being on the show. Happy Easter to you. Paul, do we have one more call? I see another one on the list here, or are we getting close to showtime?
Well, we've got a little bit of time. I will check on this call and get back with you.
Let's go to break. Everybody, thank you very much. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short message.
The Douglas James Cockrell website is where you can learn much more about this amazing man and his journey through a lifetime of spiritual prophecy. The book Secrets of Life answers questions everyone has about the physical versus the spiritual world, why you are here in the world right now, karma, psychic abilities, reincarnation, prayer, and much more about universal laws. This book is essential for those who really desire to follow the path of the divine to soul perfection. Douglas has been chosen to provide you with a keen insight into the purpose of life's journey. Best-selling author Robert Appel says, "The least you can expect from Dr. Cottrell's work is that it will change your life." Go to DouglasJamesCottrell.com and click on Shop for Secrets of Life and all of his books and learning materials.
Getting beaten up in life? Reading Conversations with the Akashic Field by Dr. Douglas James Cottrell coaches you through methods of battling fear and self-doubt to gain the spiritual strength you need for defense and stamina. Tapping into an ever-present source to help you win today. Visit DouglasJamesCottrellStore.com or Amazon today for Conversations with the Akashic Field.
Here's a little book packed with over 350 simple inspirational messages that you can use on a daily basis. It's called Gems of Wisdom. If you follow these simple steps to reach the divine within, you'll change not only yourself, but the world. A must-read for the spiritual-minded person. Available now at DouglasJamesCottrell.com. Gems of Wisdom.
We're back on the Global Village with your host, Dr. Douglas James Cottrell. Douglas, we've got Michael in Idaho on the line.
Let's go talk to Michael. Welcome to the show, Michael. Good to have you back on again. How are you tonight? Happy Easter to you.
Thank you very much, and good evening to everyone. Happy Easter to everyone.
You have a question for Linda tonight?
Yes. I seen somewhere that they have a computer software where they were able to take the Shroud of Turin and do some sort of imaging with the computer and make a 3D rendering or representation.
Yes, that's correct. I've heard
what,
of that as well.
What can you say about that?
You know, I think it goes back and proves the radiation theory that basically there's a huge burst of light. Now, I've not read where, you know, the caller before mentioned that Jesus was levitated or something. I haven't read that about it. But the burst of light, the billion watts or whatever of ultraviolet radiation, which is amazing, certainly, you know, burned in that 3D image. And basically what happened is that the body went translucent and then disappeared. And so the cloth, you know, doubled in on itself and dropped down. And when it did that, it imprinted on the garment. And that is not something that anybody's able to do. And it is basically a miracle, a mystery, digitizing it, which is what they did do. And I have not read that report, but I remember, I recall seeing it, basically proves that theory of radiation.
Makes sense to you, Michael?
Yeah, that's interesting how that they are able to do that with computer to kind of make it seem real, almost like I think they made a sculpture, didn't they?
You know, that rings a bell as well. Again, I'm not prepared to discuss that this evening particularly, but yeah, I do remember seeing that there's going to be so much more that's going to come out in the future when we're able to do some further testing. And I don't know whether carbon-14 dating will be in at that point or not, or there'll be something else that they will use. But, you know, the testing back that so many years ago is so far removed from what we can do today. I'm sure there'll be more. Just like Douglas was saying, there'll be more to tell about this. But, yeah, it's fascinating.
The program they have out now, Michael, is face recognition. I saw some social media videos in which they were taking statues of Caesar and other famous people, busts of their face, and they brought them alive. Also, black and white pictures of North American Indians, like Sitting Bull and different well-known Indian chiefs, Tecumseh. And they took the pictures and they made them alive. And it was like looking at a real face, eyes and features. And so I think I was in Oshawa and there was, they had taken a 3D image. And this was, say, 8 years ago or longer. And they were able to take the body and levitate it up out of the shroud and show it with the positions of the arms. And remind me next time I talk to you that I'll send it to you. It was something that was presented on stage. That was then. Today, I'm sure if we look, there will be somebody, if we can, you know, the old saying is, if you can think about it, somebody's already got it out there on the internet, that there's probably face recognition software that would take that image and the shroud and make it into a 3D lifelike view of the face of the Christ.
Yeah, I was looking for that kind of stuff for my phone, like an app for the iPhone that you can use that, but I haven't found it yet.
Well, I think you have to pay big money for this face recognition stuff, okay? This they're selling it to police departments and governments all over the world, and they're not going to have anything free out there on an app, I'm sure. But,
that's true.
Yeah, and besides these pictures that, I went to take pictures for a book deal I'm putting together. My son took some pictures of me. And I said, so what do we use? I expect him to haul out his great big camera that we used to use in time past. He says, your phone will do fine. I said, my phone? Well, he said, it's a i16 or 14 or whatever it is. I said, yeah. He said, well, that's high resolution. That's enough. I was shocked. It hadn't occurred to me that how powerful these cell phones are. So you might not get that on your, you know, that resolution, but I'm sure that there has got to be somewhere out there that this image I saw in Oshawa, they had the body was pulled up out of the shroud and it was like a, what would you call it? Not ballooned up, but it was pulled up out. I guess it could say like it was floating, but it was like looking in a coffin. You could see the arms folded in the, and the position like that. Remind me, if I'm correct, I'll send that picture to you. Have another question for Doug or so? What do you think of Doug's dissertation about his linguistic talents and abilities? Isn't he an amazing man?
Oh, yes, he is, very much so.
I'm not flattering. I'm impressed he uses words I've never heard of before, you know. Anyway.
Well, you are embarrassing me.
No, I don't mean to be. I don't mean to be. I mean to compliment you. Go ahead, Michael.
What period was the was Buddhism when Gautama Buddha brought in compassion and love? Was that before or was that after Christ?
I thought. Well, let me see here.
Maybe I'll, Doug would know.
I believe it was several centuries before. I thought it was after.
Yeah, I wasn't certain either.
I know Muhammad was several centuries afterwards, but Buddha, I believe, was several centuries before. But I've been wrong many times before, so if somebody could look it up, I'm not at my computer right now.
Yeah, I'm doing it right now.
You know, Doug, I have a question for you, and maybe we all can talk about it. You mentioned a word I've never heard of before, and I just wondered what you could tell me what it meant. It was a tetragrammaton or pentagrammaton.
Tetragrammaton, yes. It's Greek for four letters, basically. That's how they refer to the, without speaking the word, the sacred word, which we refer to as Yahweh.
Right. So, and you know,
it's called the Tetragrammaton.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. I didn't know that. The Catholic Church has removed the Yahweh from all of their hymns. They now replace it with Jesus instead of Yahweh out of respect for the Jewish faith. And, you know, I think that they not put in the actual vowels? Is that how they, you know, Y, W, H or something? Is that how they put it in there?
Well, the written Hebrew language, ancient Hebrew language, it was a consonant language. It's just like ancient hieroglyphics. The only reason we know how the ancient, or a good approximation, how the ancient names in Egypt were is because it's very similar to Coptic. But in terms of Judaism, there is an Aleph, which is basically only semi-vowel, but everything else is consonant.
Okay. Did you want to ask more, Linda? Doug?
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I kind of interrupted. But I just had to know because interesting.
Well, if you want to know, there are people out there in the audience from around the world, and I'm going to say Happy Easter to them right now. They are in Spain. We have people in India. We have people in Australia, people in Peru who regularly listen to this show, but it's in the archive, so they'll be listening to it in the next 24 hours or so. And there are many people who, because it's a Friday night and they go to bed early, they tell me that they like to listen to the show at their leisure the next day, in the middle of the day. And then there are people who listen to the show or series of shows, one after the other, as they're driving on a trip somewhere. So they go to Blog Talk Radio and they look under Global Village Radio Show, or my name, Douglas James Cottrell, and they download and listen to the shows, tonight's show in tomorrow, because it's archived with almost right away within a few hours. And or they can go to my website, douglasjamescottrell.com, and click on the banner, which is, you go through the front page of the homepage, and it's down there, listen to the broadcast. And so people can hear that the next day, as Paul is doing an excellent job producing a show and making sure that we have, you know, the microphones are turned on and things like that. So anybody's listening to this, you can listen to this show tomorrow in the Blog Talk archives under the Global Village Radio Show of my name. So I did a little AI kind of hocus pocus here to answer Michael's question. The question is, who came first, or was it Buddha, Muhammad, or Christ? This is the answer. The Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, I might have butchered that, the Buddha, founder of Buddhism, is believed to have lived between the 6th and 4th centuries BCE, with most historians placing his life around 563 to 483 BCE. Born in, Siddhartha Gautama, in present-day Nepal, he attained enlightenment and became the Buddha, spreading the teachings throughout the region. Next, Jesus the Christ is the central figure of Christianity and is believed to have lived in the first century CE. Most scholars agree that Jesus was born between 4 BCE and 2 BCE, and that he was crucified around 30 CE. Jesus' teachings and the events of his life are documented in the New Testament of the Christian Bible. Muhammad, the founder of Islam and the last prophet according to Islamic belief, was born in Mecca, present-day Saudi Arabia, around 570 CE. He received revelations from God, Allah between 610 CE and 532 CE, which were later compiled into the Islamic holy book, the Quran. Muhammad passed away in 632, and I should say, may peace be upon him. So that's from a quick search here, and so in chronological order, it is the Buddha followed by, let's call him Yusaya, or Jesus, the Christ, and then Muhammad. That answers your question, Michael.
Yes, I have something else to share. Well, a couple things. In Arab, Jesus' name is called Isa.
Yeah, that's true. That's that they dropped
in India.
Yeah, yeah. That's I think Doug covered that, or it was somewhere that they you know, like his birth name, as we read in the Bible, was when Emmanuel. And so, if you look at that over the years, Jesus was referred to Son of Joseph and many other names throughout his career, but or through his lifetime. But as Doug so particularly meticulously, not the word, meticulously, went through the different translations, you can see where certain letters didn't exist in the language, and the interpretation therefore dropped off his, or they changed his name. But that was also just because it was to, the name Yeshua was translated into Greek and in the New Testament, and it was translated into Latin, and it became Jesus, and eventually it was transformed into Jesus in the English language. So it went through, you know, the different changes. This transformation of Jesus in the English language, for instance, the evolution of the name Yeshua to Jesus reflects the changes that occurred as the story of Jesus and the Christian faith spread across different linguistic and cultural centers or in different contexts. So that's why there's a difference. And, however, the name of Yeshua in Hebrew means salvation or is salvation, God is salvation, and that would certainly fit more with Jesus the Christ name, as his name meant the salvation or the savior, you know, meaning to save people, and that's what his name was in the Hebrew language to start with. So names are important, words are important, getting the facts right, that's all important. But not so important as what's in your heart. And to be, for any of these, Muhammad, let's add Moses in there, and Buddha, and Christ, and the names of these spiritual divine beings who are ascended masters and are fully aware and self-realized spiritual beings, the thing that they were teaching was a four-letter word, love. That's it. And if we follow the dictates of love, then we've got to be on the right path, because that's what they were teaching. Now, there were variations of it. There were approaches to it. There were rules, and there was lessons to learn. But all that was to make you, my friends, a better person, being able to demonstrate compassion. When you have compassion for everybody, you don't hurt them. You don't cause them any pain. You know, you help them. And that's a good thing. What you give out comes back. But again, the different ways, because we have to matriculate and we have to investigate and we have to have details, and some of us need more details than others, and all these different things, that just gets us on the path. But the real revelation comes from within. You're looking in, then you find God within. As soon as you find that you have a soul, then you find liking to whatever path you choose, then you're on your way to becoming a fully realized person. Like tonight, we're celebrating what this man did, this little boy that was special, announced to the world by angels. Mother was told she was going to have a baby. She wasn't even married yet. And the angels told her what the name was. And she said, well, I believe in God. I accept this, whatever God wants me to do. And that's one of the things of being a spiritual person, is to accept whatever God wants you to do. In other words, to be of service without question. And when you know it's a spiritual duty, you follow it. And amazing things happen to you. You know, you can't see it because you don't know, you've never done it. But when you do it and you see amazing things happen to you, it's kind of like candy. Oh my gosh, I want more. And as you continue to go down that spiritual path, the revelations that come upon you make it so that you're not afraid to die. But that man, Jesus the Christ, came with a purpose, and all the sins of all the world were put on him. And for whatever he did, whatever the sacrifice he did, or whatever his mission was, or who would be vain enough to know what was in the mind of the Christ, or God for that matter, that whatever it was, it seems to be working. I don't think the mission's over. I think there's still a little bit of work to do for us. But at least here we are talking about him now. And here we are looking for salvation. We're going through these holy times, this holy week. For what purpose? To strengthen our faith. And Linda's comments tonight on the great amount of research he's done and the dedication towards understanding, I'm sure have taught many of us listening, and then people that will listen tomorrow. And I can see a lot of people, they're going to be right away, you know, going and looking in places on the internet to find out more what Linda has said tonight. That's what spiritual awareness is all about. That's what being of service is all about. Helping. So with that, Michael, thanks for being on the show tonight. Unless you have another question, I think Paul has got somebody else lined up for a question. And you got anything else to say, Michael, other than happy Easter to you, my friend, and God bless you for helping out on the Sunday services. Really appreciate it.
Yes, I have one more thing to share. And then I will wish everybody happy Easter. My birthday landed on Easter every 11 years when I was 11, 22, and 33. And the first time when I was 11, it was, what a thrill. Because
wow.
I not only got birthday presents, but I got a nice Easter basket. So and then after that, it's all spiritual. Beyond that.
Good for you. So are you kind of hinting, are you 44 or 55, whatever? 45 and 56 or whatever. So,
it only happened every 11 years, 11, 22, 33. And I did some checking, and I would be 111, 122, 133 when it happens again.
Okay.
Well, something for you to look forward to, Michael.
Yes. That's got to be worth a chocolate bunny or two.
I'll be sure to give you one when it's your birthday.
Okay.
When your next time your birthday comes on Easter, okay?
Okay. Well, listen, thank you, Michael, for being on the show. We got a couple of callers here. We got to hop. So take care, my friend, and thank you for your questions. Look forward to it.
Thank
Paul,
you.
Where are we going next?
Happy Easter.
Yeah. Oh, happy Easter to you, Michael. We'll see you on Sunday. At the Zoom
we
Sunday
are...
service, by the way. Mm-hmm.
Going to New Mexico, Melinda is on the line, Douglas.
Welcome, Melinda. You're just getting here under the wire. We're getting towards the end of the show. Welcome to the show. I hope you're enjoying the show tonight.
So my question is, do you feel that there is some Messiah walking the earth plane right now?
Is that for me or Linda? Linda.
No, that's for you, like another Jesus walking the earth.
Well, I know there are spiritual masters that are here. I know there's one that was born in India not too long ago. I saw the birth. And that will be another divine soul. And he's been expected. And he will help the people in India. And he's about 10 or 14 years of age right now. As I alluded to, our friend Jack, who... came up with this notion about when in history, where were we all sent home in the known world, and that was back at the time of Jesus just before Jesus' birthday, his birthing. And so never since in history has the whole world had to go home until COVID came along. And this was my friend Jack's revelation. And I think that's amazing. So if we're looking for signs of the time, you know, signs that always there are signs. There's a big rock in Australia that broke in half. There's a white buffalo that was born in the U.S. There are other signs of announcements for the Messiah to return or a great soul to come back. That's all happening, including COVID. So if everybody had to go home and then Jesus was allowed to come into the world, think about it as a possibility. We all had to go home for COVID. Could it be that the second coming is happening?
Make sense? Mm-hmm. What about Sanguru, like in India, that he helps even the poor? He puts people in bread and feeds them.
Sure.
I would say he's kind of like Jesus. What do you think about Sanguru? Sorry, if you don't mind, because he's very beautiful.
Listen,
man.
Melinda, it's a good question. Prophets are always assigned to the people that need them. And God puts prophets in certain times and certain places to go through certain religions and upbringings to be of service to those people in the world. If I were to go to India as a white Christian guy and say, I'm now going to be, you know, your leader, I'm a prophet, I've been told to come here, people wouldn't believe it. But like Jesus, he was born among the people at the time and in the culture he grew up there. He was of the people. And that is a sign about all prophets and all holy and divine beings. They are born into, let's say, a nation, a region of the world where they are needed. Buddha, Confucius, Christ, Moses, and on, Saint Germain, Zoroaster, okay? So the holy person is born into the culture, grows up in the culture, and then demonstrates divine abilities of compassion. So yes, there are holy people in different countries. In Argentina, that's where the Pope came from. He was an archbishop in there. He was having his battles with the president and the president's the wife and the president back in the day. But he came from poor Argentina. So there are different people are placed in different parts of the world on purpose by the hand of God. Now, I don't propose to say that that's a job application kind of thing as a prerequisite, but it's makes sense that the holy people, the inspired people, the ascended masters, the angels, the saints, the gurus, the divine beings, they would be in the city, the village, the town, the country, the religious background, et cetera, that they're needed in. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. No, thank you for sharing the information. I'm glad that there's people that do that wonderful. And I wish that I was alive looking at Jesus when he was crucified, but not happening. Thank you.
Well, it's a very important question because, you know, often people have said, well, what is the one true religion? What's the right one? Well, there is no right one. There is no only one. There is only one God. And how you choose to worship God or how you wish to be the example of that divine being to get to where you want to go, which is yourself, to get closer to God, then you have to keep your options open, and we have to be, for the future spirituality of the world will be inclusionary. We won't exclude other people because they don't look the same as us. They don't practice their beliefs in God the same as us. They don't have the same customs. They don't eat the same food. That's all in the physical world, and it's mundane. It's not important. What is important is that they all believe in one God. That's it. The people who don't believe, look out, bad times are coming. The people who believe, you will be guided and protected. So we're celebrating an amazing man, an amazing soul, a divine being who came into the world, and like all lights, he was extinguished because he was trying to bring light into the world. But because of that, it backfired. The light became illuminated, and we're here to illuminate the Christ ourselves. That's my mission, to illuminate the Christ. I'm born a Christian. I'm a practicing Christian. And I'm a believer in the one God. And I'm also including all my friends from the different religious backgrounds, of which I have looked in their holy books. I've read the Quran. I've read the Gita. I've read the Torah. I've read the Tao. I've read the Bible, New Testament, Old Testament. And the one thing it's saying is always the same. You know, don't do anything to anybody else that you won't want to have happen to yourself. And all the rules in there, you know, basically Moses was called the lawgiver. Muhammad was the same. These are how to get along with each other in practical times, in hard times. Remember those days, they didn't have electricity. Oh my God, what it would be like if we didn't have electricity. Think about that. We wouldn't be able to, you know, turn on our cell phones, our computers. What would we do? Oh my God. Does anybody remember what it was like just a few years ago when you didn't have a cell phone? Does anybody remember a few years before that? If you had a car phone in your car, it was hardwired in there and you were the envy of the neighborhood. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When I was in high school, we had little radios. We used to hold them up to our ear. It was called a transistor radio, and you were the coolest guy on the block if you had one of those radios in a leather pack and you could hold the radio up to your ear and hear it. There was no such, well, I guess they did have earplugs after a while, but, you know, you were cool. And now it's kind of like, look at my phone. I think I'll have music. Siri, play a song. Alexa, I got to watch it. I got my, they're going to answer me here. Alexa, play music, you know, how far the world has come. Anyway, I'm dating myself when I say that stuff, and I'm sorry. But anyway, interesting question. But the idea is that if you believe in God, no matter who you are and how you believe in God, if you believe in one God, the supreme God, God Almighty, by whatever name you call him, Yahweh or whatever else, you're going to be saved. You're going to be helped. You're going to be protected in this time of extremes and this time of chaos. If you do not believe, you're on your own. It's like being in the jungle without a guide. You're on your own. Prophets are like guides. And if you believe in God, there's light at the end of that tunnel. You know, you'll be nudged, directed, poked, prodded, pulled along, kicking and screaming to the light. Anyway, I'm getting tired, right? So do you have a question for Melinda? Excellent question tonight, and you got me on my soapbox here. I'm sorry about that. You got a question for Linda?
For me? Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I can ask. Okay, I have a quick question, please. Thank you. I'm a big fan of yours for years. I just barely started talking to you this year. So I just like to know, one of my close friends, we had a little bit of a terminal and got irritated. It's just, and forgive me, God, I want to be good here, always be good, good, good. And then it was just wanted to know, like, when do we come back talking to each other? Please.
Okay, the show's about Linda tonight, but I'll give you a quick answer. I can see like an elastic band pulling the person towards you. The band is stretching, but you keep pulling, and all of a sudden they snap together. So keep pulling.
Does that mean that he's leaving from me?
Yeah, that means you're pulling. It's resisting. He's pulling back, but it's like an elastic band and then it's going to snap back all of a sudden. I hope it doesn't break, but that's what I see. Anyway, good luck with that, Melinda. We're getting near the end of the show.
Thank you.
So, okay.
Thank you.
God bless you. And thank you for your nice comment, your nice words. Appreciate that. Keep listening to the show, and take care and good luck. Happy Easter to you.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Linda, we're just about at the end of the show. Any comments that you'd like to, any summary? We got a little off track there at the end. I got on my soapbox a bit, but wonderful show tonight. Appreciate the comments and summary to the audience.
Just the shroud is an amazing artifact, relic, icon, whichever, however you want to say it. This whole week is called Holy Week, and then this is just one day out of 3 days that is called the Triduum. So when you go into a Catholic church tonight, or if you did go into one, there's no holy water, and there is no host. The host was blessed from the night before and carried in, and that's just because God tonight, or Jesus tonight, gave himself on the cross and is no longer there. And this shroud actually proves it. At least to me it does, and I hope it does to many of the people who are listening. And then tomorrow night is a special night as well. We'll come together around a fire, light our candles, and actually wait for the dawn and sing Gloria again, that he is alive, that he is resurrected. So I thank you for letting me join you tonight. This is a lot of fun, and I definitely would encourage anybody who's listening to dig into all the different sources there are with regards to the shroud. It's fascinating information.
Well, you've been a fascinating guest tonight, and Doug has supplied some amazing verbiage into the mix. And for people who are enjoying in sincere solitude this holy time, it is Holy Week. My friends in Spain have been keeping in touch with me about Mass and things that are going on. And for wherever you are in the world, you know, remember, it's not over there. It's over here. It's inside. This is the pathway. This is the way to find the Christ. The Christ is in your heart. And as we look around outwardly and we see all these things and we practice our religious customs, it strengthens our faith and it gives us hope that in the future, whatever coming after tonight, that is going to be better. We certainly live in a time that is chaotic, and we live in a time that is no different than when Jesus the Christ appeared in the world when he did. So there's time. There's a need for another prophet, another voice, somebody to holler at us, somebody to provoke us and get us to love one another. And the easiest way to do that is just be nice, be pleasant, and see where that takes you. But as you go through this time, this is a time that provokes me that this man who was such an easygoing, loving, compassionate man was betrayed, was wrongly convicted, was tortured for nothing, absolutely for nothing. However, the real reason, the spiritual reason behind that, the contemporaries at the time, getting nothing out of it other than they thought they'd get rid of him and that would be it. Boy, were they in for a surprise. Look what happened. The whole world happened, the Christian world. And many people find their way to Christ in their own way, but usually it's by talking to somebody. It's by going through a difficulty. It's by having hard times. But that's what Jesus was all about. Pick up your cross and follow me, he said. In other words, that term about long suffering is to suffer, to go through the world and try to do right, and try to be right, try to be spiritual. Because there's always somebody out there. I call them the munchkins. I call them the tumbleweeds. I call them humorous names like misguided souls and things like that. It's their job, believe it or not, to try to hold you back. They give you the opportunity to be spiritual, to practice your spiritual beliefs. Otherwise, if you didn't get tested, you wouldn't really know that what you believe is really what you believe. It's just academic until you get tested. And in a way, that's what this crucifixion is all about. Jesus passed the test. Always remember, he was scared. He was scared in the garden when they came to arrest him. He told his buddies, the look out, keep watch. They didn't. He was scared when he was on the cross and he was dying. And he yelled out, Father, why have you forsaken me? Because it was so painful. So that shows us that that humanity, that part of him, it's within us. It's okay to be afraid, to be scared, but don't run away. And God will never, ever, ever forsake you. Take you down to the wire? Yes. Always to the last minute? Yes. I've felt that. I've been there, and I've had humorous discussions with other people I know in business and otherwise, and we all agree, yeah, why did it take us right down to the wire? But that's to test our faith. If you run away, well, you're doomed to go through the experience again. But if you don't run away, you graduate. And what you're moving and moving towards and graduating, you don't know because you're not there yet. But that's what the resurrection's all about. We're resurrecting our soul. We're forgiving ourselves of the difficult things and maybe even the bad or evil things we've done. Sincerely, when you repent, you wipe out the debt. And then you know better. Don't do it again. Don't repeat the sin, being off the mark. And good things happen. I know that from experience. I know that I've had many times of difficulty in my life. I know I've made mistakes. We all have. And then in order to forgive yourself, you have to come to that point when you're in that quiet moment and you say, like, hey, I'm human. No human gets it right the first time. And that's what Jesus was showing us. That's why his disciples, after Jesus passed away, became true believers in the Christ. Because they saw him, he was resurrected. And all but John suffered horrible deaths at the hands of the bad guys at the time. That is the testament to how their faith was, that they believed in the Christ. Remember, when he was being arrested and tried, which would have happened a few days before tonight, they all ran away. They didn't know him. They denied him. But thereafter, when they saw him resurrected, they laid down their lives to put forward his word, his mission. Something to think about. We're getting near the end of the show, and I wanted to say, Doug, thank you very much for that contribution. And we have people asking, and I think from now on we'll refer to Yeshua as Jesus as often as possible, because it means salvation. Doug?
Hello.
Can you hear us, Doug? Yeah.
Yes, I can hear you, yes, of course.
Okay.
I always listen. I don't always say much, but I always listen.
We're ending the show, and I'm giving you an opportunity of any summary or...
Oh, well, all I'm going to say is I'd like to thank Linda for immense contribution to the show. I learn a lot, and I listen very acutely. And I also like to reassure you, Douglas, when 2040 gets here, if you forget, I will remind you that the Shroud is going to be shown again.
Yeah, well, by 2040, I think I'll see the guy who was wearing it, actually, by that time. There you go, Linda. Thank you for that. Paul, we got any... Paul, where are you? We got anything else going here? Any?
I'm right here, Douglas.
We've gone through all the callers.
We've gone through all the callers, and I think it was a fascinating topic tonight. I was introduced to the Shroud in the mid-70s when Time magazine made it a cover story, and I was fascinated. I read the whole thing, and from that point on, I was hooked on wanting to know more. So through the years, I have tried to keep in touch with the latest comings and goings of what the Vatican is doing with it. So I was enlightened to, or I was glad to be enlightened by Linda and Doug and Douglas tonight with new information for me. So thank you.
Well, you're very, very welcome, Paul. I want to remind everybody that we have other communications. We have our podcast. We have our Hope conferences coming up. We have our Sunday virtual healing service. This is our Sunday service. It'll be extra special. This is a good time to pray. This is of the most important times of the year. This is a time to pray. Pray for all the benefits that you want or need. And pray especially for the enlightenment of your soul and for a blessing to your soul. But we have some various places to donate. If you want to be a friend of the show and you can afford to give us a tip or a few dollars, the email address is douglasjamescottrell.com. And if you could send us $10 by a wire transplant or a bank transfer, that send it to douglasjamescottrell@gmail.com. douglasjamescottrell@gmail.com. I get my website mixed up with the email. Oh my gosh, don't send it to my website. It's douglasjamescottrell@gmail.com. And if you can afford a few dollars and you enjoy the show tonight, it helps to defray the enormous expense it costs to put this out to you on our show. We're providing tickets for any of you who would like to meet up with us in Phoenix, Arizona for a Hope conference coming up in late May. Go to official hopeconferences.org and you will be able to find out more about this exciting time. We're going to have some dynamic speakers at this Hope conference. This is a time to bring light into the world. We need you to attend. We need your participation, and tell everybody you know that this is being available. I'll be there, and we're going to have a wonderful virtual healing service. And we're going to have some, again, amazing speakers and people doing demonstrations, and that's in Arizona. That's coming up in May. We also have the website that you can go to as well as hopeconferences.org. We have the Many Mansions Centers.com. And the International School of the Prophets.com. That's where you can get the Zoom link and attend to our Sunday service for free. So with that, I want to say thank you to everybody who's out there. Wow, what an incredible journey we've had tonight on the Global Village Radio. We've been exploring dynamic shrouded terrain as we wrap up our discussion. I'd like to extend my heartfelt gratitude to all those who contributed to tonight's success. First and foremost, a big thank you to our co-host, Doug Bentley, and also my appreciation to our guest, Linda, for her enlightening perspectives on history, science, and spirituality surrounding the Shroud of Turin. Your passion and knowledge have truly captivated our listeners. Our show wouldn't be possible, of course, without the hard work and dedication of our producer, Paul Hughes, and behind-the-scenes engineer, Jack Balick. I want to thank you both for your tireless efforts in making Global Village Radio a show we can all be proud of. And last, but certainly not least, I'd like to extend my deepest gratitude to you, our listeners, for tuning in and joining us on this fascinating journey. Your curiosity and engagement make our show a vibrant and dynamic experience for us all. As we close tonight's show, I want you to, mark this down. And we have upcoming guests in the next few weeks. Eric Koberle, War in the Hearts of Men is his book. Felicia Searcy, The Impact Multiplier. Dr. Paul Hanna, Holistic Healing, and all about that. And Kim Cantin, Where Yellow Flowers Grow, a personal journey of how she lost her husband and messages from the other side. Also joining us in the near future is Patricia Corey, who has a book, Hacking the God Code and a Conspiracy to Steal Your Human Soul. Oh, my God, that's going to be an interesting show. Be sure to mark your calendars and join us for another thought-provoking conversation right here on the Global Village Network. Until then, on behalf of Paul, Jack, Linda, Doug, and myself, I am Douglas James Cottrell, wishing you a very wonderful, sincere, and happy Easter. May the divine move through you, watch over you, and bless you always with health, wealth, and peace of mind. For those that are going to tune into our Zoom virtual healing service on Sunday, see you there. God bless each and every one. Good night, and God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Global Village Online Radio Show with your host, Dr. Douglas James Cottrell, and co-host, Doug Bentley. Brought to you by MindPro Publications and Productions, a division of Douglas James Cottrell & Associates, Incorporated. Copyright 2023, Douglas James Cottrell. No part of this broadcast audio may be reproduced in whole or in part without expressed written permission.